You know, Jesus wasn't racing past everybody to get to the next cocktail party. He was simply sitting down with people, making friends with people, and just hanging around there, trying to introduce them to the God who is love. So slowing down and taking time for those things that the world considers to be trivial is profoundly important for everybody, but it's profoundly important for Christians.
Hi friends, I'm Amy Julia Becker, and this is Love is Stronger Than Fear, a podcast about pursuing hope and healing in the midst of personal pain and social division. I have been waiting for a long time to talk with today's guest, John Swinton, and it really seems fitting to me that this conversation would be the final one of this podcast season. I will be back with more fantastic conversations in September, and if you have anyone you think I should be sure to talk with next fall, please let me know. If you aren't already a subscriber to this podcast, I'm going to encourage you to pause right now and go subscribe, and then you will know in September when I've resumed recording. I would love to have you as a part of this conversation going forward. All right, now let me tell you about today's guest. John Swinton is a theology professor at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, and he has very thoughtful and profound things to say about theology and health and disability. John wrote a book called Becoming Friends of Time a few years ago, and I return to this book and I recommend it to people regularly. I highly recommend it to you as well, and you'll get a little taste of it as we talk today. The thing that's cool about John is that he's not simply a writer and a thinker, but actually someone who worked as a nurse for 16 years before he got his PhD and became a professor. You'll hear again a little bit about that today. So these thoughts about dementia and disability and mental health, they all emerge out of a lived experience as both a nurse and as a Christian. So I'm really glad that we will all get to hear from those wise words today together. I am here today with Professor John Swinton, who is joining us from Aberdeen, Scotland. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's so nice to have you. I think I reached out for this interview. I mean, it was months ago, and your travel schedule made it. You said, well, June would work. And I said, I'll take it anytime. It's really a thrilling thing for me to get to talk to you because I've really been influenced by your work for many, many years. And I've always wanted to have this conversation on the podcast, but it came up for me again because in the book that I just wrote, To Be Made Well, I quoted you a couple different times. Because you were the first person, maybe the most influential person for me in thinking about the idea of health. And what I remember long ago was reading some of your work on how the idea of health in our modern Western society is really different from a biblical idea of health, and how that actually can distort our understanding of health in general, and from a theological perspective. So I thought maybe we could start there as a way of introduction to you and to your work. So feel free to take a little while just to tell us who you are and how you've come to be someone who's writing in various forms about this concept of health. But I'd also love for you to explain that distinction between what most modern, you know, Europeans or Americans at least would think about when it comes to the word health and what a biblical understanding of health really is.
Sure, I'm not happy to try. Well, my background is in mental health nursing. So I nursed for 16 years, originally in the area of mental health, and then I retrained and worked in the area of what's now called intellectual disability, which are then called mental deficiency, then called mental handicap, then called learning disabilities. And so these terms change all the time, which tells you a lot about the instability that lies behind the way that we name people who seem to be different. And so most of my early years were spent with people who were going through complex situations. People who were living with schizophrenia, people with bipolar disorder, people who had profound intellectual disabilities. And these were very formative years for me because...
And those, those like early years, meaning the 16 years when you were nursing?
Yeah.
Okay, so like when you were actually kind of in the practical sense of working with people, not just in the theoretical thinking about this.
Yes, yeah, good point of clarification. So yes, so my actual years of nursing were formative.
Yeah.
Because when you spend a lot of time with people who have different life experiences from that, which people assume to be norm, first of all, you realise very quickly that they're not that different. Mm. That actually very often people just see the world differently, and that different angle can be very helpful. That's not to say, suggest that there's no such thing as a mental health challenge, or that we should discount the difficulties that people encounter. But at the same time, we need to listen to these kinds of experiences, because you do begin to see things differently. So I did many years in nursing, and then I moved into academia, and I did my undergraduate degree, and then I moved on to my PhD. But I did my PhD in on schizophrenia and Christian friendship, which is very, very interesting, because schizophrenia is one of these highly stigmatized conditions that people work off stereotypes and caricatures rather than working off people. And so you have a big stigma that attaches itself to something like schizophrenia. And so people are marginalized, they're misnamed, they're rejected, they're treated very badly, very often by society. And so I think I started to think, well, what would Jesus do? Mm. And then that took me into the friendships of Jesus. Because when you look at the way that Jesus befriends people, it's like a very different model of friendship from the one that you and I might assume to be the norm. So if you look around your friends, and particularly if you're a Facebook person, you'll see that a lot of your friends share your same interests, look more or less like you do, have the same beliefs, and so on and so forth. So you get that idea that we become friends because we have something in common, because like mm-hmm. attracts like. But the principle of the incarnation is that God, who is radically unlike human beings, becomes a human being. Mm-hmm. And more than that in John's gospel, offers friendship. So friendship becomes a new mode of discipleship, but it's Christ-like friendship that becomes a new mode of discipleship, i.e. Jesus, who sits with the tax collectors, with the sinners, with those whom society marginalized. And so it's a very different type of friendship. And so if we're thinking about the church as a community of friends, you can see immediately how important that is for somebody who lives with something like schizophrenia. But one of the things that always struck me in relation to mental health, and also in relation to intellectual disability, was that standard ways of thinking about health and illness meant that some people were always ill. Mm. And so if you get something like schizophrenia, which certainly can leave you, it's possible to fully recover. Many people, maybe most people, just don't in that sense. And what does that mean? Does that mean you're ill forever? And yeah, by kind of biomedical model, it would mean you're ill for them. So you have to take your medications, your life's possibilities are narrowed. But if you keep taking this medication, then you'll have some kind of health understood as absence of symptoms. Or not even absence of symptoms, control of symptoms, because mm-hmm. you know, we can't really get rid of symptoms in that way. Which made me think, when I kind of moved from nursing into academia, I started to think, well, is this a biblical way of thinking about health? And as soon as I started to look at that, it was very clear that something else was happening in the Bible in relation to health and in relation to healing. And so if you take something like the woman with the discharge of blood in the Gospels, right? It's a fascinating story. So she makes her way through the crowd and she touches Jesus' cloak, and power goes out of Jesus, and immediately she's cured. Mm-hmm. And Jesus notices this, and then they have this conversation. But then at the end of the conversation, Jesus says something really strange. He says, "Go, your faith has healed you." Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, but she's already been healed. But then you begin to realize, no, she's been cured, but she hasn't been healed. It's when she's sent back into her community, it's when she's able to reestablish relationships with her family, with her friends, with the temple, with God, that the healing comes. So curing and healing are not necessarily the same things. So healing is to do with connection. It's to do with connection with yourself, with your community, with God, which is why Jesus said, I imagine, that the sum of the law and the prophets is to love God, love neighbor, and self, because that's true healing. And if we think about that idea of healing as reconnection in that way, mm-hmm. then it becomes clear that people who live with enduring mental health challenges or people who live with forms of disability that just always live with them are not unhealthy. It's actually just a different way of living. And healing isn't getting rid of these things. It's helping people to be connected. And all that ties in with the kind of that biblical perspective of shalom, mm. which is at one level is just peace, but actually the core meaning is justice, righteousness, holiness, to be in right relationship with God. So to be healthy is to be in right relationship with God, self, and others.
So I have a question there. What role do you, from your own experiences and theological imagination, what role does the body play in thinking about health and healing? Because if we're talking about relationships as the core of health and healing, and yet I think most of us start with a bodily illness or pain or disability as that's what needs to be healed. And I'm very, very resonant with you as far as the ways in which our social relationships, our spiritual relationships, our relationships even within ourselves need healing. And yet, yeah, what role do you see the body playing in healing?
Well, it depends what you mean by the body. And so when we talk about the body, we normally think about this physical thing that we move around in, and of course that is your body. But within the philosophical field of phenomenology, they have a really interesting way of thinking about the body. So you have two dimensions. You have the material body, but then you have the lived body. Mm-hmm. So the material body is that physical thing that we carry around with us, or we are kind of the sense of the separation of body and mind, but the thing that we exist in and touch the world with. And things go wrong with that, and things need to be fixed. Sometimes they're mended, sometimes they can't be. So it's a complicated thing working out what bodily existence is. Mm-hmm. But the lived body is what occurs when that body engages with the world. Hmm. When your flesh and bone moves through the world, experiences relationships, experiences brokenness, experiences joy, all of these things that we go through, the lived body is this place where we do that. So when we're thinking about the body in it, particularly when we're thinking about healing, we're not simply thinking about the material thing of flesh and bones, but we're talking about how that interacts with the world. It seems to me that, you know, the incarnation, God becoming a human being, is a good example of that. At one level, God becoming a human being means the Word became flesh and lived amongst us. But it's the lived amongst us that is fundamentally exciting, and where we begin to discover who God is and find how our redemption is. So there's a really intricate connection between the body and the way that the body lives itself out within the world. And when we're talking about health and healing, it's important to keep those two dimensions of the body in critical tension.
So I'm curious to think a little bit, as you know, I have a daughter with Down syndrome, and so I think about intellectual disability as it relates to everything, but health and healing and a biblical just understanding of the world. And when I was reading your book, this most recent book, Walking with Jesus in Strange Places, you talked about working with people with intellectual disabilities and how that, I have your quote here, challenged your evangelical imagination. And so I wanted to ask you just to define what that means, evangelical imagination, and then also how that work with people with intellectual disabilities changed and challenged that imagination.
Yeah, I probably would have been more accurate to say my Presbyterian imagination. Because Presbyterians love words, right? So preaching, teaching, everything comes through words. Salvation ultimately comes through the proclamation of the word and the receiving mm-hmm. of the word and being able to articulate words. So words are extremely important for Presbyterians. But of course, that's highly problematic for people who don't have words. So what do you do with that? Are words the only way that we can contact God, or the only way that we can experience God? And of course, my working alongside people, particularly people with profound intellectual disabilities, challenges, all of that stuff. Because if you either have a God who says, no, I'm not really interested, if you can't speak, which poses a problem for all of us as we get older and as our brains degenerate, or we need to nuance our theology. Not to get rid of words, but begin to think about how we can find an understanding of what the word is intended to do that incorporates somebody else. Because the words themselves are not the point, it's what the word does, which is to draw people to Jesus ultimately. But there are two theological moments that I found revelatory or enlightening in relation to that. First one was in Jeremiah 22:16, if I remember correctly. When Jeremiah's talking about King Josiah, he says he's a good king. Why is he a good king? Because he looks after the widows and the orphans. And then Walter Brueggemann, this Old Testament scholar, points out that the prophet says this. He says, is that not what it means to know me? To look after the widows and orphans, is that not what it means to know me? Because we normally think, well, you know, we come to know God and then we do good things. But that passage seems to be saying, no, actually, your relationships, your relational encounters with the world, are a way of knowing God. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really, really interesting, that knowing God is a relational process. The second moment came when I was reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book, Discipleship, which is a fascinating book. And there's a chapter in there which is titled Matthew's Call. And it's just simply Bonhoeffer reflecting on Jesus calling Matthew. And he points out that, you know, the assumption very often is that Matthew must have known things about Jesus. Right? And so he must have heard the stories. He must have been told this, that, and next thing. But Bonhoeffer says, maybe, but you have to go beyond the text to say that, because the text doesn't say that. The text simply says, Jesus called, Matthew followed. Hmm. And it's really interesting. So, when you think about the disciples, they didn't know who Jesus was. They didn't have that cognitive ability to know who Jesus was. They were constantly confused and constantly bickering amongst themselves. And even after the resurrection, they were uncertain. Yet they were still disciples. So following Jesus isn't simply knowing things about Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's actually, you know, that encounter with Jesus, which is more than simply your cognitive abilities. Which makes perfect sense in the light of the body, because in the body of Christ is marked by diversity, not by uniformity. So if you have words, that's fantastic. You're able to help all of us to understand God in that way. If you don't have words, that's fantastic. You can really help us to understand God in that way. And it's only when we bring together these different dimensions of the body of Christ that we understand what it means to follow Jesus. So these two theological moments can push me to expand my evangelical stroke Presbyterian imagination.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had a really similar experience. You write a little bit about something that happened with me when Penny was really young. There was a woman who had an adult child with Down syndrome who came to visit me. And one of the things she said was that she, even though the other people in her church thought she didn't or shouldn't, she allowed her daughter to take communion because her daughter was not able to say, I believe with my mouth in, you know, Jesus Christ, and I believe in my heart and confess with my mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord. And yet this woman was, in her mind, doing this subversive act by allowing her daughter to take communion and to participate in the body of Christ. And I, at the time, didn't have the theology to back it up, but I had the sense that there was something very profoundly right about what she was doing in saying, my daughter who is here worshiping with me and in relationship that is evident, even if not through words, with God, should be more than welcome at the table to receive the body and blood of Christ. And yet she was coming out of that same space that you're describing of it's only through words that we can do this. And you also write about the, within all of this, the dangers of hypercognition, that there's this sense of a hierarchy that can get set up in our understanding of ourselves and of God, in which the people who have the words right and can proclaim them properly are the ones who are either the only ones who are saved or maybe a little less terribly, like the ones who are the most valuable. But either way, there's a distortion ironically, of the Word of God, I think, and of the person of Jesus, certainly, and when we go that way. And I wanted to go back to just when you were talking about the idea of caring for the poor is a way of knowing God, the Jeremiah verse you just mentioned, because you also mentioned that in the book, and I was paying attention to that, because I just wanted to think about, like, so if a relational process, I think you said something about, like, knowing God is a relational process, right? It's not just a cognitive one. And yet it's also particularly a relational process with widows and orphans or with the poor. It's not just, as you were saying before, like a relational process with other people who are like me and who will keep me comfortable. Yeah. And so could you talk about that? Like, what, who are the poor? What does it look like to be in a relationship of care that's not a relationship of patronizing? I think about the fact that people with disabilities and dementia and mental illness can be used as like kind of props for charity or abstract theological insight rather than being seen and known as like the full image bearers of God that they are. And so I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about what does it actually mean and look like to be in relationships of care with, you know, quote unquote, the poor.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So one way I would think of it is in relation to care and the way in which culturally we tend to downgrade the receiving of care, that somehow, you know, people with certain forms of disabilities or dementia is a very good example, are somehow a burden on society. Mm. Now, this is how I would think about it. So in the Genesis account of creation, there are two creation narratives. So the first creation narrative, God creates the world and gives human beings dominion over it. So the Latin is dominus, I think. But it's a Hebrew word, it's a very strong word to crush down and hold the world in its place. Right. Mm. So you get that sense of chaos and then human beings saying, hold it in its place. But in the second account of creation, God gives Adam responsibility to care and to tend to the world. So care is built into the creation dynamic. To be a human being is to participate in God's continuing care of the world, to care and tend for the world. So if care is a primal gift of that God's given to human beings and an aspect of what we are, then the necessary corollary or accompaniment to that is to be cared for. So to care and to be cared for is to be part of being a human being. So if it comes to that time in your life where all you can do is be cared for, or if that's the way your life has always been, you don't lose your dignity. You don't become a burden. You simply reclaim an aspect of our humanness that society has forgotten about. Mm. And so I think when you begin to think of care as something that's reciprocal, as something we give and take to each other, give it to and take from, receive from each other, and sometimes it's not reciprocal. Sometimes we just receive it, but that's simply receiving. It's just another gift of creation. It's just another way of being in the world and another way of discovering our humanness. So I think when you begin to look at care in that kind of biblical, reciprocal way, then a lot of the problems that we have in relation to patronizing attitudes towards mm-hmm. people with dementia and also care, uncaring attitudes, begins to take a different frame. So that's the way I would begin with that. But the second dimension to that is that we do live in a world that is fallen and broken. It's being redeemed, but it's not been redeemed in all of its fullness yet. So we have to always be careful of the inherent tendency that we have to kind of make mistakes with one another, to overpower one another, to put false names on people, to put false relationships onto people. Because particularly when we're thinking about people maybe with profound intellectual disabilities or advanced dementia, these guys are in a situation where they've lost a lot of the power that they have to tell their own story. And when you lose the power to tell your own story, other people start telling it for them. And when other people start telling that story in a context where, you know, your intellect is really important, you can bet guarantee that the stories that are told are going to be negative stories. So we have to be careful about that power dynamic. Because when we're receiving care, giving care, telling stories about people and receiving stories. So it's a complex thing, but I think there is a way in which we can do it that maintains dignity, even in the face of situations where society says, you know, there is no dignity.
Yeah, I love what you just said in terms of just like the forgetting essentially who we are, that actually when we are caring and receiving care, that's a remembering of what it means to be human at our essence. Almost no matter which, if you're on the giving or receiving end, there's a reclaiming, or there can be a restoration to humanity that happens in that. And that does, however, as you're talking about, like, it goes, the values of our society do tend to say, when you are filled with words and using them in a quote unquote productive, which generally means like money making and efficient way, then you are a valuable human. And so when you are in a place where that is not the way of your way of being in the world, you are a burden. And you're obviously, and I think the Bible is very much challenging that understanding of humanity. And I'm wondering to just take it to a different aspect of these differences, both between a biblical understanding and like the values of what God values and what we value. I'm thinking about your book, Becoming Friends of Time, and the relationship between time and I'm thinking specifically about disability and the idea that slowing down and like walking at the speed of love is very much a challenge in our modern world. And I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about this relationship between time and disability and really what that has to do with this idea of like health and wholeness that's different from how we understand it.
Yeah, the issue of time and disability is very important. But the issue of time and humanness is very important, because we live in a society that is kind of obsessed with time. So we buy time, we lose time, we waste time. Everything you do with your money, you do with your time. So time is currency in a very specific way. And so if you're a person that doesn't have that currency, then you're in difficulties. If you're not able to use your time productively, if you're not able to use your time competitively, then you fall very far short of the cultural norm of what a valuable life might actually look like. And you can see that work itself out, for example, when people retire. So you ask somebody who's retired, what are you up to? They say, I'm busier than ever. So, you know, I've never been so busy. And I'm thinking, when I retire, I don't want to be busier than ever. I want to do nothing. But then you begin to think, well, the reason people say that is because busyness is cultural currency. Mm-hmm. It gives you value. If you're doing things, if you're producing things, then you're valuable, which is why retirement is such a crisis, because it's a spiritual crisis, because everything that you've got in life, you know, in terms of what gives you meaning and purpose and value, disappears when your job disappears and your identity is tied in with that, et cetera, et cetera. But what I want people to think about is maybe God moves more slowly. And so the idea in that particular book of the 3 mile an hour God, which is Kisuke Kiyama's book, called the 3 mile an hour God, is a kind of, it's a metaphor for the incarnation. It goes like this. The average speed that somebody walks at is 3 miles per hour. Jesus, who is God, walks at 3 miles per hour. God, who is love, walks at 3 miles per hour. The love has its speed. That's the slow speed. And when we begin to take that on board, you can begin to see things differently. If you've ever spent time with somebody with a profound intellectual disability or somebody with advanced dementia in particular, you'll discover that you will know nothing about them if you're moving quickly. But if you slow down and take time to be with them, you discover all sorts of things. You know, people listen to this may have experience with somebody with dementia, where if you're sitting with that person, even for a few seconds, you can lock into something's different. You know that somebody's functioning in a different way, you're able to respond to them in a different way. But you can only do that when you move slowly. I suspect that that's how Jesus would work. You know, Jesus wasn't racing past everybody to get to the next cocktail party. He was simply sitting down with people, making friends with people, and just hanging around there, trying to introduce them to the God who is love. So slowing down and taking time for those things that the world considers to be trivial is profoundly important for everybody, but it's profoundly important for Christians.
I have a couple of other thoughts in response to that. One, I was just going back to the story of the woman with the issue of blood, which actually the book that I just came out with centers around that story and how even that encounter between Jesus and that woman is in the middle of Jesus on his way to heal someone else, Jairus's daughter, and yet he is walking and he pauses for longer than is necessary in order to heal her, well, in order to cure her anyway, I think. But actually, maybe this even brings this point out that she is cured without him really slowing down, just by reaching out, right? But it's that healing, that deeper restorative work that happens because of the encounter with Jesus, which can only happen by having it take time. And then the other thing I'm thinking about, I wrote a piece for Plow Quarterly this past year about love and time and Down syndrome. And this experience I had with Penny when we were at a national park, and she moves more slowly than the rest of our family. And so sometimes we all slow down, and other times one of us will say, I'll walk with Penny, and everybody else go ahead and do your thing. And it was really interesting because I found myself wanting to tell a narrative of slowing down with Penny. This was a day when Peter and Marilee and William had gone ahead. And I wanted my narrative to be that I saw better things because of the slowness. I appreciated the nature more, and I noticed the owl in the tree. And at the end of our walk, it was like, no, I saw less. Like, Peter and Marilee and William got the more spectacular experience of this park. What did I get from slowing down? I got my daughter. Like, I got this time with her. That's what I got. Like, I didn't get a spectacular vista. I just got her. And that was all I needed. Like, that was where love was in that moment. And it was just a telling moment for me, because I am someone, even having learned all of these things, I'm still someone who rushes and who just likes to get things done. And I'm so grateful for both the witness of Jesus and the presence of Penny in my life, just of that invitation to slow down and to trust that is where love so often is much more, I guess, accessible. It's not like love isn't present when I'm rushing, but I'm much less likely to receive and participate in that love.
That's right. That's good. It's a great story.
Well, I'm curious also, though, about Jesus's miracles in the Gospels, in which healing seems to happen very quickly. Right. I mean, like, there's this instantaneous physical transformation happening, whereas it seems to me that there's also something to be said for healing taking time. And so I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about that, like whether healing does take time, but sometimes God just decides to speed it up, or whether there's something else that's going on there.
Well, I think we need to be careful when we think about the healing miracles, in particular in relation to disability, obviously, not to read back into history of what we think is going on from our current biomedical perspective, right? So reading back into second century Mediterranean culture, what we think Jesus was doing as a doctor, for example, would be to completely misunderstand what he was up to. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things about the miracles is they had theological intent. In other words, they were meant to tell you something about God and meant to tell you something about who Jesus was. You know, when Jesus has encounters people, and then you know, at the end of the encounter, he asks, "Go, your sins are forgiven." Right? So who can forgive sins? Only God can forgive sins. So therefore, Jesus is God. Mm-hmm. So you can see that time and time again. So that's what these miracles are intended to tell us something about Jesus. So they're not medical, they're theological. It's not to say that it's not a great medical thing that happens in terms of physical mm-hmm. transformation, tremendous, but they're not intended to be like, so therefore we can all do the same thing, because we're not all Jesus, not trying to draw attention to self in that way. So the signs and wonders designed to help us to see who Jesus was, what the coming kingdom is. And so they come instantly, because it's a surprise, it's a sense of dissonance to break into our present reality and open it up, and suddenly we see God different, suddenly we see Jesus different. That's their intention. It's fantastic that people have relief from their pain and their suffering, there's no question about that, and God does do that, that's up to God to do that. But the intention is to help us to see who God is, rather than mm-hmm. simply to have something for ourselves. So most healing comes slowly. You know, you cut yourself, it'll take you, I don't know, weeks or months before that begins to heal it up. So our natural bodily state indicates yeah. that that's not normal, which is why it's called a miracle. But our natural body state is that we do heal when we're broken. And that's psychologically and also physically. But it does take time. Mm-hmm. And so the two are similar, in the sense that there's things happening in our bodies, because I mean, clearly Jesus changed the biochemistry of the people that he touched or worked with. But the intention of one is different, and the process in the other is quite, quite different. Because healing does take time, physical and psychological healing. That's probably how.
Well, and I think there actually, I mean, as I think about it, there are a number of stories where, again, that instant revelation of God's, whether we're talking about power or compassion, or even just ability to heal, is nevertheless followed up by something that takes time. I mean, and this is not true in every single instance, but I'm thinking about like Bartimaeus being invited to follow Jesus, and you have to assume there's some ongoing healing, right, that's happening, that is not about his eyesight, that's about him as a human and following Jesus. Or the man with leprosy, again, that word, they're cured, the 10 lepers who go to present themselves in the temple, but the one who comes back to Jesus and says thank you is the one who is healed in that fuller sense. And that, so there is even in those stories a sense of time, again, different than what we think about, you know, there's an instantaneous, miraculous something that happens, but there's still time at work in, I think, that bigger picture experience of healing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's helpful for me. I'm curious, as we start to come to a close, I'm curious to think about how to live this out. Like for you, obviously you're spending a lot of time thinking about this, but what does that mean in your everyday life as a Christian? What does it mean to practice slowness, or to practice thinking about health, not in a biomedical way, but in a relational way? What does it look like to be in ongoing relationships of care that are mutual and more in touch with the humanity that God has given us, rather than the humanity we try to manufacture for ourselves? So yeah, how do you practice this?
One way in which you can practice slowness, because in reality, at least within our culture, it's very difficult for people to live slowly, because if you're working in a busy healthcare system or you're a busy supermarket or wherever you are, it's very difficult to function that way because of the way society is set up. But I always think, you know, when the people of Israel were being horribly oppressed and treated unjustly, God's response, amongst other responses, was to say, well, take a Sabbath, take a break, and think about me and remember me. And I think that's a very powerful thing to do. Again, culturally, taking Sabbath in that way, I don't know, how could you do it? And how could we continue to function if we don't have firemen or police or whatever it is?
Right.
But there is a really interesting, there's some interesting research on what's called micro breaks. So micro breaks are when you take 2 or 3 minutes just out of your busy working day and step back and reflect, you know, what am I doing? Why am I doing this way? Why is this, why am I feeling this way? Getting a bit of distance from where you are and then going back into your busy situation. And when you do that, you see it differently. Because when you're wrapped up in busyness and speed, you can't really make sense. So if you're, for example, in healthcare, the temptation is just to get caught up in tasks and forget about people because it's so busy. But if you take a micro break, step back, and then start back in again, you see things differently. And if you want to frame micro breaks as kind of like miniature Sabbaths, Sabbath moments where you step out, get your perspective, focus on God, step back in. And so you'll still be moving at fast speed, but you'll actually be moving slowly because you'll be able to see the landscape that you're working in a quite a different way. So that's a, I think that's a very practical, almost meditative way of dealing with how you can become slow in the midst of busyness. With regards to relationality and the development of the kinds of friendships that Jesus urges us to develop, I think it's impossible. Well, it's not impossible. We always need to be careful not to try to enforce relationships on people. You know, I want to be your friend, so I'll follow you around for the next 10 days and make sure you're... But what we can do is create communities where friendship becomes a possibility, where our preaching and teaching is not oppressive in the ways that we've been talking about. When we preach the word, we're always aware that that language itself may actually exclude somebody else, and we need to think about how we can think differently about the language we use so that it's inclusive. I don't mean to shave off the sharp edges of our tradition. What I mean is just make sure everybody can understand it, make sure it makes sense in the context of where we are. So by creating communities where friendship is a possibility, I think that's a beginning point for developing the kind of body relationships and body of Christ relationships that I'm thinking about. So being aware of the way you teach, being aware of the way you preach, being aware of the way that you're creating fellowship communities within your community is a space to begin. In other words, being intentional about recognizing the differences within our communities. Because it's the intentionality. When things just hum along under the hood, that's when things are problematic. But if we can have the kind of conversation we're having here embodied in the ways that we teach and fellowship, then at least we can create spaces where friendship might be possible. And with God, of course, everything's possible.
You know, that might be the way we're supposed to end this podcast. With God, of course, everything's possible. I do. All right. But I'm going to ask you one more question. My last question is thinking a little bit bigger picture about. So we've talked, I think, a lot about personal experiences, relationship. I love that thought of like micro Sabbaths and just slowing down throughout the day. And obviously, it's a little bigger picture to think about like a church community. But I'm also thinking about just the divisions that exist in our society, whether those are political or racial or in terms of the hierarchies we've talked about already, as far as like you're a burden and you're a productive member of society, right? Like all of those dividing lines. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about like becoming a healthier society, right? Like we have these kind of, how do I become a healthier person in the what we've been talking about, that relational sense. Do you think a healthier society comes from that very personal experience with God and within these like small local communities, or is there more to it than that?
There's more to it than that, I think. But I think you begin with yourself. Mm-hmm. I think it begins by recognizing who you are, the way you think, and why you think the way you do. And as Michael Jackson once put it, if you want to make the world a better place, begin with yourself and make that change. So you have responsibility, in other words. But one of the interesting things, I just finished a little book on evil. Didn't cheer me up very much. One of the things I discovered was when Paul talks about evil in the beginning of Romans, he basically says it's evil occurs when you try to substitute yourself for God. When you try to substitute things of human beings for the things of God, evil becomes invisible because you can't see it. You can't. It's no longer possible to see it because you've already persuaded yourself that things that are obviously horrible are actually okay. And so you take something like the killing of George Floyd. So you've got people looking on, seeing something horrible happening, but then you have other groups of people looking at exactly the same thing and seeing nothing wrong. And the reason they see nothing wrong is because within that system of thought, this was a normal way to behave. But as long as evil remains invisible, you can't counter it. Within society, the way in which we think about disability, the way in which we respond to people with disabilities can very easily function along the same ways. The language that we use around disabilities, within mental health, for example, you use language such as schizophrenic. And what on earth is a schizophrenic? Is it like a Spaniard or a New Yorker? Mm-hmm. And so your language creates a persona which you then treat very unjustly. But it feels normal, and that language feels normal. You talk about mental handicap, that language feels normal for some people because that's the way we've always talked about it. Stigma, the idea that you can identify somebody by one aspect of them, this person has a limp, so therefore they're a cripple. That way of thinking, that way mm-hmm. of is basically evil. But we don't see it. We can't see it, and so therefore you can't counter it. So spiritual discernment and being aware that within the way that you think about things like disability, there is a lurking sense of evil that you may not be aware of, but you need to have your consciousness raised to, is profoundly important. Because if we can't see it, and we can't see the way that people with disabilities are treated unjustly inside and outside of the church, then nothing's ever going to change. Worse than that, it'll just get worse and worse and worse, because that's kind of what evil does. So my sense would be that we need to think seriously about spiritual discernment when it comes to thinking about the way in which we as a culture think about and respond to people with disabilities, along with many other things. Because it could be, if we have a systemic bias against people with disabilities, then that's when horrible things start to happen.
Absolutely. And while you were talking, I was brought back to something you wrote in Becoming Friends of Time. The essence of sin is the human tendency to imagine a world without God. And so there's again, these two acts of imagination, one that we might not even know we're doing, which is what you're talking about there, where evil becomes good and perhaps even good becomes evil, right? Even that idea of someone being a burden and therefore we don't need them and can compassionately, put them out of their suffering or something. So that can go both ways, but that imagination without God is what is going to give us those systems and structures of oppression. But then on the flip side of that, going back to what we were talking about before, that sense of allowing our imagination to be formed and shaped by the love of God is what can help us to live into that place of shalom and of health for our own selves and our little communities, but also on that broader level.
That's real good.
Well, thank you so much, John, for your time. It's been so great to talk with you and just get to at least begin to explore some of the depths of the things that you've thought about and worked on over the years. And I certainly hope that people who got to listen in on this conversation will also pick up some of your books and think and live more deeply into this. So thank you so much.
Yeah. No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, as always, for listening to this episode of Love is Stronger Than Fear. You can check the show notes for links to the books and passages and articles that we mentioned today. And if you are going to miss hearing my voice for the next 2 months, I want to remind you to subscribe to the podcast. And also, you can check out the audiobook version of To Be Made Well, narrated by me. So whether or not you spend your summer listening to me, I do hope it is a wonderful one, and I hope to see you, not quite the right word to use, hope to encounter you again in the fall. As always, I am grateful to Jake Hansen for editing this podcast, and to Amber Beery, my social media coordinator, who does more to support this show than anyone will ever know. As you go into your day today, I hope that you will carry with you the peace that comes from believing that love is stronger than fear.